Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Freedom Flare Co. podcast. I'm your host, Joey Page, and today we're going to be doing some historical commentary and storytelling about the Lewis and Clark expedition that took place during the early 19th century. And in the spirit of the early 1800s, I'll say, load up the wagons, saddle up the horses, let's go out west. Yeehaw! Our great story begins with the ultimate question of why did they go on this expedition in the first place? Well, we like to call that the Louisiana Purchase. So in 1803, the United States paid France $15 million for the Louisiana Purchase that I just said. It was the equivalent to about $340 million today. 4 cents per acre, you guys. They paid 4 cents per acre. And they got 828,000 square miles of land west of the Mississippi River. Essentially doubled the size of the United States for context. This greatly strengthened the country when it came to material good opportunities, strategic from a military and strength perspective, providing this powerful impetus of that westward expansion and, you know, giving confidence to the colonialists to go out west and confirming the doctrine of implied powers of the federal constitution. This was really a big deal, obviously. So we acquired all this land, and then the big question President Thomas Jefferson and all the rest of us, the people had was, well, what's out there? What do we have out there we need to go explore and see what exactly is west of this Mississippi? So the three goals were, it was to set up a mission. Let's set this expedition up to establish a trade network across the country. We knew there would be Native Americans all across the country. That is the obvious. Befriend the Native Americans that were encountered and confirm or deny this theory that there was an all-water Northwest Passage to the Pacific Ocean. So those were the three main goals that we had in creating this expedition, this large quest. Now, the big thing we're getting to now, it seems pretty organic, is, so who do we hire to go on this quest? Well, we knew that Jefferson was all about wanting to investigate and map and document what was out there, in order to encourage people to want to move out west if it were true of that theory about there being water passage to the west. So he proposed this mission of discovery. It was called the Corp of Discovery. He chose Meriwether Lewis, and then Meriwether Lewis tapped William Clark. And the two of them, we had Captain Meriwether and Captain William Clark, who were leading the way. Now, Meriwether Lewis was one of Thomas Jefferson's besties, a very close confidant, and that is why Thomas Jefferson went to him first. He was a soldier. He was an explorer. He was Thomas Jefferson's personal secretary. And when you have this crazy contentious election between Thomas Jefferson already happening and decided that he was in control, Jefferson really leaned on trusting Meriwether Lewis to make sure that he could be his close confidant in writing private notes and making sure no one was trying to like sneak attack on Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson did get a little bit paranoid, which no one really talks about. We'll have to save that for another story. So what was Lewis in charge of? Lewis got tapped first. Meriwether Lewis was tapped first. He was in charge of planning the expedition, making sure that we had the proper scientific methods planned out, medicine, geography, planning out the items that would be needed to log said geography, examining the existing maps and journals to really be like, okay, I think this is the way we should be going based on what we think we know. Then we have procurement. So Lewis was in charge of obtaining weapons, the construction of all the boats, keel boats, little boats like canoes, iron frame boats that would be assembled during this expedition, because the goal was, yes, do much on land, but try to be mostly on water. Because when you're on water from a strategic perspective and you have no idea where you're going, that is your ally and best friend as far as trying to remain safe from whatever critters or Native Americans that may not know that you're there to come in peace And so by being on water, that was the goal. Try to stay on water as long as you can and only go on foot when you need to go like do some map research, questing, study plants, whatever, get hunt, right? Cartography. So Lewis was the expedition's main cartographer, built making the maps. And then obviously exploration. And that's where, when it came to the exploration piece, Lewis knew to tap William Clark because this guy was a frontiersman, a Davy Crockett in like, you know, OG of Davy Crockett's was Clark. Clark is the one who mapped the Missouri River and was like just fearless when it came to going out and exploring stuff. So he knew that Clark was the person you'd want to have to make sure that everything was safe, which is a good transition to who the heck is this guy, right? So Clark, in addition to me telling you he was a great frontiersman, incredible draftsman. So from a protection standpoint, hunting, being able to help and train and teach an army to hunt and remain all safe together, Clark was a key ally in that. And then Clark had a genuine fascination with the ethnographic studies of indigenous people. And for those of us who are like, what does that even mean? Basically just like was so fascinated by Native American culture and had a genuine appreciation for it as he was a frontiersman. He had seen it all. He wanted to learn more and explore it all. So he had a genuine curiosity about how to encounter Native Americans and continue to spread a message of peace. We got Lewis, we got Clark. Now, who else came with these people? They had an army of 40 men, unmarried men. And that's right, ladies. I know for me, my husband said, hey, I have an opportunity to go explore the unknown and leave you here high and dry, I'd be like, no, thank you, sir. You are not going on that quest. Thank you. No. So it was 40 unmarried men. Kind of funny fact there. And we then also have Sacagawea. Now, Sacagawea was a Native American interpreter. And her job was, she was a Shoshone Native American girl, little girl, teenager, who was their guide, interpreter, and her number one goal was to act as the Native American cultures believe in this idea of matriarchy and that women are the hierarchy. In the hierarchy of their societies, women are the pillar. They're the pillars of peace and strength. And so their idea was also that by having Sacagawea, if they ran into other Native American tribes, the fact that they saw her, the tribes would know that they were not there to be a warlike people and they were coming in peace to try to have conversation and learn about the land. Sacagawea was very important on this entire quest. I don't know what it would have been like without her there to be able to provide that level of being able to take down the tone of running into people you've never seen before that have a bunch of guns and weapons. You know, think about that as we tell the tale. Now, during the expedition, a lot of stuff happened and there are tons of different like encounters and stories, and I'll go through a couple of them, but this is the fascinating thing. So this expedition lasted from 1804 to 1806. It was a 2-year expedition. Think about that. They went from St. Louis, Missouri, out to Oregon, the Oregon coastline, to Pacific Ocean, and back in 2 years. That is really wild stuff. They were moving. And I was looking at that. The group averaged 10 to 20 miles a day. And they were traveling by boat. So, you know, they weren't just like on foot doing this. They were hustling on the boats. But they did do a lot of the side quests to go research the animals and the plants. I find that to be incredible. They did nearly 8,000 miles all in, going out west and back east. And they discovered over 178 new plants, 122 new animal species. They encountered over 50 different Native American tribes, including the ones we may know, the Shoshone, the Mandan, the Blackfeet, the Chinook, the Sioux. And it was through a lot of those encounters and all of Sacagawea's work in communication and peace that they were able to develop these first contact protocols for meeting new tribes to make sure that people knew, like, hey, we come in peace. And that's a incredible thing to think about how many Native American tribes there were that I identified as like completely different groups all across that 8,000-mile stretch going out west. Now, Sacagawea, I'm fascinated with her. It's a cute story. She fell in love on the trip. Who wouldn't? She was the only girl. You know, what did she have to lose? There were all these dudes. Ironically, of all the dudes on the trip, on the quest, she didn't fall in love with any of those guys. She fell in love with a random guy that they were going up into the Dakotas. And up in that land is where the Mandan and Hidatsa tribes are. And she met this Frenchman. She didn't even meet one of the Native Americans. She met a Frenchman who was a fur trader. His name was Toussaint Charbonneau. Toussaint. I love it. The French trader was the beaver fur. So she fell in, you know, girl fell for the fur. You know what I'm saying? Hey, you don't, I mean, what it is what it is. It has not, times have not changed, ladies. So Sacagawea, she falls in love with this French trader and they get married. And she gives birth to her first son, John Baptiste, at 16 years old. And they continue on out. She gives birth to a baby and they continue going out west. Wow. To me, that is just, you go, girl. Power to you. So as they kept going, they go out. Then they started to come backwards. After they get out west, excuse me, I'm going to wrap up Sacagawea's tale here. And they were coming back. And returning to St. Louis, they had stopped in the same villages where she had met Toussaint, and they ended up deciding to stay in with the Mandan and Hidatsa villages and stay there with those people and settle there where Toussaint was more comfortable and they could just live a life there. And in that time, also, Sacagawea had given birth to a second daughter, but I'll spill the tea on that in a moment here. So one thing that's important is as they dropped off Sacagawea and, you know, her sweet little baby John Baptiste and Toussaint at the villages up in the Dakotas on their way back, that Clark wanted to make sure Sacagawea knew how much he appreciated her help and her support. And he promised to her that if she ever wanted him to take John Baptiste to get a formal education, he would fund it 100% and support that little boy to make sure that he had the world at his fingertips. And I think that's so sweet and such a telling thing of who William Clark was when we talk about the fact that he was this frontiersman with this true appreciation for Native American culture. And that remained to that day. So one other fun story I wanted to share about this trip was that a hunting accident. I think this is the funniest story of all. Everyone got sick. People got diarrhea, whatever, eating yucky foods. Nobody died. Nobody died. Of all these people that went all the way out west, 8,000 miles, no one died from being shot. No one died from being attacked by an animal, any disease. However, I'm going to do a dot, dot, dot and say there was one guy that passed away right at the very beginning of the quest, but he got appendicitis and he had it before they left. So this one, that doesn't count. I don't personally think that should count. No, and because nothing that was of effect of the expedition killed anybody. Isn't that incredible? All those people went out and came back and they were fine. So going back to this great story, the hunting accident, they were on the return journey coming back from Pacific Ocean in 1806. So they're coming in at the home stretch and they're out hunting elk. And one of the guys in the army, his name's Pierre Cruzat, he accidentally shot Meriwether Lewis in the buttocks. Yes, that's right. You heard it. That's correct. Just like Forrest Gump, he got shot in the buttocks while they were hunting elk. I think that is just the silliest, funniest thing ever. I guess it happens more frequently than we talk about. But that's a great one. Funny story there. So they get back after doing this wild, long journey. And the big question I had for me when I was looking into this story years ago was like, what happened to them afterwards? Like, you know about the quest. We all know it was a difficult journey, I'm sure. But like, where did these guys land? So Lewis, Meriwether Lewis, he came home, was a total hero, widely celebrated. He was gifted Thomas Jefferson. Thank you so much, bro, for all you did. Woohoo! We're going to make you the governor of the Louisiana Territory in 1808. And unfortunately, Lewis's abilities as this expedition leader didn't translate into politics. And anyone out here in modern day knows that being a leader and being political are two completely different things. And it just wasn't his thing. And Furthermore, Jefferson started to really push Lewis to wrap up all of the documents and the maps and all these journal entries and all the information they collected on all the species, the plants. Lewis was, you know, the clock was ticking and Jefferson was like, dude, like, finish the stuff. I want to, can we get the information? It had been a couple years. He's like, can we wrap it up? So there was a lot of pressure that Meriwether Lewis put on himself to finish all of these logs from this journey. And it really created a lot of stress for him. And then it trickled into other stuff. Like, the dude became an alcoholic. He had financial problems. I'm sad to say that this gentleman was not lucky in the world of love. He had trouble like finding a wife. Like, just, he must have been weird. I don't know. I would love to meet this guy. But he also just was struggling. Okay. The guy was struggling. And, so after 3 years, after this cross-country expedition, he was 35 years old. He was so young, and I say was, because he passed away. And he, historical evidence shows that he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. So, in other words, there are theories that he ended up ending his own life because of all of the pressures I had just mentioned, though there could be other theories out there that are floating around these days that, because it's not quite logged, that perhaps because he was in like a drunken stupor, he may have accidentally shot himself as well. So that's a piece of history that is a little bit foggy, though it's best to just say that he ended up ending his life, is I think how we all portray that in history today. Now let's get to William Clark. I don't want to bring this down on a low here. We're going to take it back up a notch, end it on a high. Woo! Okay. So William Clark comes home and he was appointed as the principal Indian agent to the Louisiana Territory. And in 1813, he also was given a governorship of the Missouri Territory. And unfortunately, the guy wasn't that great at politics either. So in 1820, he lost his election to become the governor once they made Missouri an actual state and established it as a state. But that was okay for him. This guy was like no love lost. He was so happy about all of other things going on in his life. He actually got appointed to be the superintendent of Indian Affairs in St. Louis. And he was great with that. Like, that was his jam. That was his bread and butter anyway. So he helped do that until right before he passed away. And the guy lived a good long life back then. He was 68 years old and passed of natural causes. And one other thing I think is cute is that he was a very devoted family man. And I think you can kind of get that from the storytelling about him being this frontiersman and just really loving to see about the Native American culture. And one cute thing was that with Sacagawea, when John Baptiste, her son, was born, Clark promised he would try to make sure he gets a great education because he was committed to that reciprocity and joy of supporting education for this sweet little baby boy, you know. So he was a good man. He's a good man. So he's a good family man, as we would expect. And he had this wife. He had five kids. And he named his eldest son Meriwether after Meriwether Lewis. And it's a very sweet thing. His wife did pass away, unfortunately, his first wife, sooner than he did. So he remarried and was fathering a couple other kids and stuff like that, you know, the circle of life right there. But good man, good, solid man, good dude. All right. Now, Sacagawea, where does her story go? We know that she decided to settle up in the Dakotas, right, with Toussaint and her little baby boy. I'm so sad to say that Sacagawea ended up passing away shortly after giving birth to her second child, a girl named Lisette, and this was in 1812. So a few years later, you know, 1806 was when Jean-Baptiste was born. 4 years later, she gave birth to Lisette, and she passed away at this fur trading post. And it's a bless her heart, you know. And what I think is kind of cool and weird, as I processed the story, was that her husband, Toussaint, he ended up taking both of her children to William Clark in St. Louis, Missouri, and after the death had happened. And because Clark had promised, you know, I will provide for John Baptiste, and in letter, by the way, it wasn't like, I'm going to tell you this. It was written down and penned to Toussaint and to Sacagawea that he would always be there to support them, whatever happens. And so Toussaint brought Lisette and John Baptiste to Clark, and Clark adopted them as his own kids and raised them as his own children. What an amazing guy. Who is this man? I want to meet this man. Okay. So then I was curious, and I'm sure you are too, ladies. This is like Bridgerton novel-esque type stuff. You know, what happened to Toussaint? This dude dumped his kids and then went to live in his mid-70s, serving as a guide and interpreter for fur companies on the Upper Missouri River. And once Sacagawea passed away and he dropped off the kids, he ended up getting married like two times after, before he died. And that was the end of that tale. I mean, the guy, I don't understand that. It could have to do with the fact that, you know, what was, when he knew, if he knew Clark could offer a better life for those children, I think that maybe he did make a good choice as a father, but this is up for some serious debate. So that, but that's the story. This is the full actual tea behind the people in the Lewis and Clark expedition. From, you know, we got this giant piece of land. We covered the Louisiana Purchase for practically nothing, the best deal ever. Oh, my goodness. And Thomas Jefferson taps his buddy Lewis, who taps his buddy Clark. They get this team of 40 fearless army men, and they go out and explore in such a safe and well thought out manner, come back. And, you know, some stories don't end as happy as others, which is also just a very big reality check for people, too. But amazing that if it weren't for these people, we wouldn't know this beautiful country that we have, know and love today. And we wouldn't know that there would have been that passage of waterway to get out to the Pacific Ocean, and that all these different tribes we make contact with, and being able to really help grow and strengthen the country and encourage people to go out west. Really great stuff. So that is it. That is the story of the Lewis and Clark expedition. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you had as much fun as I did. I look forward to sharing yet another incredible historical story for you all very soon. In the meantime, don't you dare hesitate to visit freedomflareco.com. You can find the maps from this journey. You can find the actual timelines down to the day of this journey listed on there. And you can find so much more about great American history on our site, freedomflareco.com. And if there's an American story you want to hear, that you want me to tell to the people, by all means, drop us a note on freedomflareco.com. You can go right on there and let us know, and we'd be happy to tell it. Until then, everyone, don't forget that the heart of the family illuminates the American spirit.